411. You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. Tap into the pulse this hour. 411 Teen talks with Disability Rights Florida, formerly known as the Advocacy Center for Persons with Disabilities, a federally mandated agency. Any Floridian with a disability-related issue is eligible to receive disability rights services. The programs include client assistance program, protection and advocacy for individuals with developmental disability, protection and advocacy for individuals with mental illness, protection and advocacy for individual rights, protection and advocacy for individuals in need of assisted technology, protection and advocacy for individuals with traumatic brain injury, and protection and advocacy for voter access. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and joining me, I welcome Sylvia Smith. Sylvia is the Director of Legislative and Public Affairs at Disability Rights Florida.
Thank you for having us, Dr. Hollyfield.
Welcome. Glad to have you. Raziella Rodriguez is a bilingual advocacy specialist.
Hello, everyone. I'm really excited to be here.
Glad to have you. Melissa Genesol is an advocate.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Brian Funk is an attorney with Disability Rights Florida.
Good evening. Glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you all. A big welcome to you from 411 Teen. Why do we need Disability Rights Florida? Whomever.
I'll get started. This is Sylvia. Our agency is 35 years old. And 35 years ago, the first of those programs was created by Congress, and it was created to address widespread abuses in facilities where people with developmental disabilities lived. And at that time, that was the only choice available to families who needed assistance with a child with developmental disabilities. And fast forward 35 years, we have many more opportunities to be included in the community. But it takes advocacy behind almost every individual and family to help them have their rights be respected and honored throughout their lives.
Okay. Anyone else? Any other comments?
Well, from a this is Brian. From a legal perspective, so many of our laws that have done so much to enrich the lives of people with disabilities, like the Americans with Disabilities Act, require that those laws effectively be enforced by the people that they are protecting. And it can be, and believe me, I say this as an attorney, it can be very difficult to really understand your rights and your roles under those wonderful laws. So it takes a specialized agency like ours to help people to advocate for themselves and to assist them to make sure that all of the rights that have been given to them over the past several decades are preserved and increased to the fullest extent possible.
Okay. Now, with Disability Rights Florida, you provide service for individuals with disabilities. All disabilities? Are we talking about all disabilities? Are there any limitations there?
Yes, we do assist with all disabilities, physical, psychiatric, developmental disabilities from mild to severe, and we do cover the whole entire state of Florida. And so we do welcome everyone to call us.
Well, how does one access your services?
One may call our toll-free number, which is 1-800-342-0823. They may also go on our website. We have ways that they can fill out forms, online intakes. And our website is www.disabilityrightsflorida.org. Or we also welcome people to come into our office and speak to us.
And where are you located?
We're at 2728 Centerview Drive. We're Suite 102 here in Tallahassee, Florida.
And hours?
8 to 5, Monday through Friday, and online intakes 24/7.
Okay. Now, all ages?
Yes, all ages. Infants, children, school age, elderly.
Oh, okay. Give me an example of how you may assist an infant.
Well, their parents can definitely call us, caseworkers, anyone involved in, that child's family is welcome to reach out to us.
Okay. In addition to that, are there volunteer
opportunities. So often individuals in the community may hear about this organization. It may be something that they think, wow, I'd like to volunteer or, you know, participate. What would they do? What's the process for that?
We have a very robust internship program, and we're so grateful for all the universities and community colleges in the towns where we have offices, which includes Hollywood, Florida, and Tampa, as well as Tallahassee. We have interns from the College of Law. We have interns from the College of Communications and two or three other colleges in both in Tallahassee, FAMU, and FSU. And then we have, I would say, our most honored volunteers are our Board of Directors members who serve as volunteers and our PAMI Advisory Council members. And those are that's an advisory council to the board and the staff on the needs of people with mental illness. And those are extremely valued, robust volunteer opportunities statewide.
Okay. So anything that may be used to increase or maintain or improve the functional capabilities of individuals with disabilities. Is that right? I got that. If I have that right, anything. Okay. Can you fine-tune that for me? I mean, when we say anything, give me an example of how you may intervene. Melissa, I know that you are an advocate.
Yes.
Okay. But can you share how you have intervened?
Sure. Our agency is divided into different issue teams. Depending on the issue that you're having, you'll be sent to a specific team, such as our education team, our investigations team, our community team, or our employment team, where there are advocates and attorneys on all those teams. A case can be assigned to an advocate investigator who will speak to the person, determine what next, how best we should assist them. We can make contact with other agencies on clients' behalf. We can investigate and review records. We can attend meetings such as IEP meetings or meetings between consumers and other agencies that they may be having disputes with, as well as writing letters, different things like that, providing information and referral. We also have a litigation team that consists of attorneys, of which Brian can explain more about that as well.
Okay. Brian?
Sure. Sometimes issues can't be resolved with advocacy. You know, of course, we always want to work things out in the most amicable manner possible, and usually our advocates are very, very successful at that. But some issues require actual litigation to resolve. Some of those, it's just built into the system. For example, one of the issues that I've handled often enough are Medicaid service denials. When the state denies a service to an individual receiving Medicaid services, that individual is entitled to a legal appeal of that denial. And oftentimes, if the situation seems appropriate, our attorneys will intervene to assist that person and will represent their interests on their behalf. And we handle everything from those administrative appeals all the way up to federal class action litigation.
Okay. Now, is there any cost involved?
No.
Okay.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
No. No, go right ahead.
No. One of the advantages of our funding flowing through those federal grants that you mentioned early on is that all of our services are provided free to our clients.
One of you take us through the process. I'm someone who's interested, and I think that, you know, I need some assistance. What do I do? How do I do it? Is it an intake and referral? Can I self-refer? Or do I have to have my physician refer me? Just take me through the whole process.
You can definitely reach us in any way. You can call, you can fill out an online intake, or you can come in. And then you would talk to someone like me, an advocacy specialist. Mm-hmm. If you speak Spanish, you can talk to one of our bilingual advocacy specialists. And we kind of run through, kind of figure out what the situation is, what it is that you need. Is it a service? Do you have a question that needs to be answered? And we do try and handle it. Like you said, information referrals is an option. Definitely guiding the client or the caller to an appropriate agency or a publication that might assist them in answering their questions. If it requires more than information and referral, it may be forwarded to a team. Like Melissa mentioned, we have four different mm-hmm. teams. So the appropriate team would then reach out to them and try and assist them by means of advocacy. And if not, like Brian mentioned, it would just be taken up a bit. So
I think a really important principle for callers to be aware of is if they contact us, from the moment they initiate contact, it's confidential. And the process thereafter is what we would call client-centered or person-centered or client-driven. Mm-hmm. So any actions that our staff take on behalf of an individual are at their direction with their consent. And many of our callers want to take action first on their own behalf and need a little quarterback mm-hmm. in their corner to help them. As Brian described, the laws are complex. And so sometimes our role is technical assistance to an individual while they navigate a process independently, but with some expert advice in the background.
Let's say I'm a patient in the state hospital, or I'm an inmate and, you know, incarcerated. But I feel, you know, I have some issues that I think are relevant. What do I do? Are there any limitations to those you take? Would you turn me down? How would that work?
I can speak on behalf of the agency that individuals who are in those settings are our highest priority individuals because the risks that they face are profound. Mm-hmm. Because they cannot leave the setting and escape a situation where there might be abuse, neglect, or rights violation. And especially with regards to the what we call the trans-institutionalization of people mm-hmm. with mental illness from state hospitals to local prisons and local jails and state prisons, we do have some monitoring rights in some settings. There are a few settings that are excluded. All individuals should be afforded rights to access us by telephone. And in many licensed facility types, that's in state law. A special additional enforcement is in state law, where the state law may say that our phone number has to be posted by a phone or okay. that the facility has to guarantee. That's a given in sort of the federal rights access, but it's important in the licensing scheme for the state regulators to go check on that, which they do from time to time. So it's a very at-risk group of folks that we're concerned about.
So what I hear you saying is that you really have access to go into the jails, to go into halfway houses or wherever. If a client or a potential client calls you, you have the right to pursue that.
Agreed.
Okay, there are no limitations?
Well, there are some limitations.
Okay.
But generally speaking, the laws that designate the Federal Protection Advocacy Program, of which we are Florida's representative, do grant us very broad authority to perform monitoring and investigations and visit clients in virtually any setting, public or private. There are some restrictions. For example, in certain settings, we're not allowed to interrupt the ordinary course of daily activities mm-hmm. or treatment programming. But other than those important considerations, we do have pretty broad authority to go in and investigate.
When we say advocate, we know by definition of the word, but just what do you do? And Melissa, I'll direct that to you.
As an advocate, we are trying to, you know, seek out the best interests of the client. If you feel mm-hmm. like there are any sorts of rights violations, if you are denied a service that you are needing, we can, just as I said before, we can go ahead and intervene and act on your behalf. We can make calls for you. We can try to set up meetings to ensure that your rights are not being violated. We can investigate, review records, write letters, do state complaints, different things like that to ensure that your rights are being protected.
Okay. So you are there for the client totally?
Yes.
Okay. All right. And again, how do we contact you?
Our toll-free number is 1-800-342-0823, and our website is www.disabilityrightsflorida.org.
And you're located physically?
We are at 2728 Centerview Drive, Suite 102 in Tallahassee.
Okay. We're talking with Disability Rights Florida, and they're giving us the spiel. They're telling us everything we need to know. They are here to advocate for whatever you may need, all individuals who may have any type of disability. Now, this is a federally mandated program. Are they in every state?
They
are. So somebody may be listening, and, you know, they may be in Alabama, or they may be in Georgia. They might think, yeah, that's good information, but what good is it going to do me?
They might have a different name in the different states. A lot of the organizations in the other states are named Disability Rights in the name of the state, so you can check that way first.
Okay.
Or you can check on our national network's website to find your state's contact information. We're part of the National Disability Rights Network, and they help coordinate access for people who don't know how to start finding their We call ourselves the PNAs. We're Protection and Advocacy System, PNA agencies.
Okay. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll return momentarily. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and we are talking with the community of Disability Rights Florida. Disability Rights Florida is your program, your agency to support you, whatever your disability may be. As we look at Disability Rights Florida, this section of the program, I kind of would like to focus on maybe the programs and the interventions that you may have for families and children and adolescents. I kind of like would like to look at that. Special education, and I would think individuals in special education would be that population that you particularly would address. Am I correct, Sylvia?
Definitely. There's a high need for information. The laws governing a child's rights and a parent's rights in education and special education are fairly complex. The state laws change fairly frequently. I wanted to make a plug for the information that's available on our website, which is a nice self-serve way for individuals to poke around and see what's available there. And there are videos there and little fact sheets there on really priority topics for families when confronting special education challenges. And our staff have some significant expertise in that area to either write information or work directly with families.
Okay. How do you verify or validate the claims that various individuals may have?
Would Brian or Melissa like to take that one?
Sure. We are actually fortunate enough that to have several of our advocates who are trained investigators who have received specialized training that empowers them to investigate claims made by our clients and prospective clients and organize that information in order to help us proceed through advocacy or litigation if that's the appropriate outcome.
Okay. Now, I know in looking at the programs that you have various goals that you have set for the year. Do you mind? Let's look at some of those goals for 2014. Do you mind sharing those with us?
We would love to share those. And anyone who wants to pipe in, just pipe in. We have our works organized in six goals. And those are designed to communicate to the public as easily as we can the kinds of problems that we prioritize.
Excuse me. How are these goals developed? Where do they come from?
We have a process that is led by the staff but is combines staff's experience you know, sort of their mm-hmm. their knowledge of what callers are confronting. And we do a really robust outreach to the public where they answer an easy survey to tell us what they think the most important problems are. And we do those face-to-face with people in facilities. We do those through the internet. We do those on paper. So whatever the means of communication mm-hmm. is that someone needs, we can accommodate any communication method. And then our board of directors, who are really our eyes and ears, and our PAMI advisory community with their specialized knowledge and experience, all is contributed to mm-hmm. a process that takes us a few months each summer and results in our board adopting these goals, usually in the late summer and early fall, September often. And then we proceed with the work. It's worth noting that the goals don't vary substantially from year to year because, unfortunately, the barriers that individuals with disabilities face can be quite – the word I'm looking for is they're not permanent barriers, but they can be very persistent. Challenging, persistent, perennial barriers. Mm-hmm. And so I'll just jump in and name a couple goals, and the rest of you feel free to kind of talk about them. But, for example, education and employment, okay. those are – always significant issues, and we think they're really important to young people.
Oh, very much so, very much so. I know you also have abuse and neglect, and I think that's goal number one, if I am correct. You want to eliminate abuse and neglect of individuals with disabilities. Will you elaborate on that and talk about the kinds of abusive situations that you have encountered? Maybe sharing some situation where there was some question, maybe the lay public would not think it's abuse, you know, because this is educational and I'm trying to inform the listening audience. So if you could share an abuse or neglect case.
This is Melissa.
Okay.
We do a lot of abuse and neglect investigations in institutional settings. Mm-hmm. Such as state hospitals, assisted living facilities, nursing homes, different things like that. We also do abuse and neglect situations in school settings. People may not think that there's much to look at there, but we do abuse and neglect in schools. A lot of children with disabilities also may be impacted by that in their school environment as well as institutional settings.
So often when we say abuse and neglect, we often think of physical or mental abuse. But there is also the situation where individuals will take advantage of those financially.
Not only financially, but the denial of access to medical mm-hmm. care is really crucial because sometimes the situation means that there's a barrier for the individual to make their own appointments and get themselves physically to care. So we definitely see and are concerned about access to medical. In terms of financial, one of the things that we prioritize in our case selection are situations where maybe an individual is capable of making decisions about their finances, but they're under a guardianship, which is really overbearing and unnecessary. Mm-hmm. And they would like to and they have a guardian who doesn't respect any of their choices. We do some work around assisting them to try to get their rights restored or to get a guardian of their choice who – because under Florida law, guardians are supposed to take their ward's preferences into account. Right. And since the authority to – you know, to utilize their funds is given to the guardian. It's a big issue. And there are lots of other kinds of – I will say this. There are these little limitations that we try not to burden the public with knowing. But, for example, if it's exploitation of a financial nature mm-hmm. by a family member, we would not engage in that. That there is a state entity designed to handle that. If it's by a maybe a rep payee or guardian, we might look at that. So mm-hmm. we're focused on the services that are publicly funded and really need to be accountable to an organization like ours for whether they're, you know, fair, honest, in the best interest of the person, at the person's preferences, et cetera. So in the abuse neglect area, allegations against family members are typically referred back to the state mm-hmm. abuse hotline, but issues related to public employees, whether they and private employees in hospitals and facilities and schools. Those are all important
to us. As we talk about special education, one area of that may be abused, I think of often, is the whole seclusion and restraint. That, do you encounter that a lot with kids who are in special ed or those individuals who may be incarcerated? And if so, how is that addressed?
Yes, we do encounter that, okay. Restraint and seclusion. And, for example, on our website, we do have some policies and procedures and information on restraint and seclusion and to inform the parents as far as their rights and what to look out for. And we do take calls like that. And if, you know, it requires some investigation or advocacy, we do forward that on to our education team to review the situation and see, you know, if there was inappropriate restraint, if the parent did not consent to that. So it's definitely something we value.
Melissa, as an advocate, what would you identify as one of the most challenging components of your job, of your responsibility?
I would say sometimes it's a little bit difficult. It can appear that agencies sometimes perceive that when we call them, we might be confrontational. They might want to put up a, you know, a stance against us. But I think talking with them, providing them information, explaining that we're just all looking out for the best interests of the client, it overcomes that block that you initially get.
Okay. Would you agree, because you're also an advocate?
Yes, I do agree. And we do provide information and sometimes and referrals, and the client will attempt to reach that service on their own and might, like Melissa said, reach some resistance to provide them with more information about it, or they may leave out some of the rights that person may be entitled to, in which case that's why we try and give them as much information as we can. Our website, like Sylvia said, is a great resource, and we have other links on there of other agencies and publications to make sure that person's well-informed.
What about the teen who may be going through a transition? And when I say a transition, I mean maybe from high school onto, you know, independent living, maybe going to a community college. What are your transitional services? What do they provide?
Well, there are two major issues that I see in the transitional period, and I'm sure that Melissa or Razzie might be able to give us some more. Okay. But the two that I tend to deal with are the transition of Medicaid services from the state plan for Medicaid to Medicaid waiver services, and more importantly sometimes, the transition of employment services away from the school districts and to the state's vocational rehabilitation organization.
Okay. Go right ahead.
I'm sorry. I agree with Brian. What I see a lot of dealing with the school system is students who have reached the age where they need to develop and be involved in their transition IEP. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there are difficulties there, like Brian said, with the transition services from the school to the workforce or to Division of Vocational Rehab, and making sure those services are implemented and written into the IEP and then followed through with after high school.
It would be great if you could give some examples of what is a transition service.
Well, sure. At a very basic level, let's say that a young woman with a disability is in high school and she wants to be a computer technician or a computer programmer. While she's in high school, she'll be working with both the school district and the state's vocational rehabilitation organization to help enable her to pursue those career goals, because the state has a vested interest in making sure that people with disabilities are able to work to their fullest possible potential. So when she's 16 years old, the school district may provide her with education or access to a computer to help her develop those skills. But after age 21, the school district's involvement with that individual is no longer there. So before that, the individual needs to transition to utilizing vocational rehabilitation services in order to continue receiving those services that are necessary for her to enter the workforce. So instead of receiving computerized education through the school, she might be given funding to attend a community college and take computer programming classes through vocational rehabilitation. But handing off those services from the school district to the VR agency is a delicate and often mistaken process that requires a good deal of knowledge and work to make sure that it works out for that individual and there's no interruption.
Great.
So is the process of entering post-secondary education. And I just wanted to mention that we do some work at the systemic level on some of these problems because some of them are too cannot be solved for everyone one at a time. Mm-hmm. And the state of Florida would like to see, and we would certainly like to see, more students graduate with real diplomas, higher expectations of their ability mm-hmm. to do so, more support for their ability to do so, fewer students tracked to the special diploma, which disallows them from entering post-secondary institutions. And luckily, that's a priority of some leadership in the legislature, so we're trying to help them come up with solutions. But when they get to post-secondary, I remember a client we wrote about in one of our annual reports where our staff spent 2 or 3 years assisting them with the inner relationships between and the denials, the repeated denials by either the post-secondary institution with regards to accommodations that they needed and had documentation to support the need for, or vocational rehab, or it's quite a number of barriers when it comes to getting through to post-secondary, and it's a significant priority of ours to assist students. If a student has a disability and wants to get to working or wants to get to post-secondary education and is running into bureaucratic barriers, for lack of a better word, you know, if it just like the red tape becomes mm-hmm. confusing and they feel like giving up, that's a good reason to call us.
Well, and talking about red tape, I think IEPs themselves, and you all had mentioned IEPs, IEPs themselves are problematic often for parents. Can you elaborate and talk a little bit about how you may help or assist parents with IEPs?
Sure. Our education team works with parents who are having difficulties or concerns regarding their children's individualized education plan. We can assist from the very beginning, from the process of getting evaluated and qualified for an IEP, through the process of a parent being denied services that they may need for the student to be successful in education, to anything that a student would need in order to be successful, such as accommodations or services on the IEP. We can get involved. We can review. We will review the IEP. We can attend IEP meetings. We do attend them in person sometimes when possible, and over the phone as well. So we try to assist to ensure that the student has the IEP that will best meet their need in order to have educational benefit.
So I would think that anyone who needs an IEP can be supported and represented or assisted through disability rights, because if it's an IEP, therefore you must have some issue.
Definitely, there's a presumption of eligibility there. Mm-hmm. I would take this opportunity to say that another way for people to help us mm-hmm. is through donation.
Okay.
Because it would not be accurate to say that our resources allow us to help every student with an IEP. There are probably 250,000 students in Florida who have IEPs.
Let me ask you to hold that. We're going to come back and talk about IEPs. We need to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. This edition of 411 Teen is talking with Disability Rights Florida. Disability Rights Florida advocates for all folks with disabilities without regard to race, color, creed, national origin, gender, sexual orientation, age, ancestry, marital status, veteran, or draft status. Sylvia, I had to interrupt you, but we were talking about IEPs, and I think that's very valuable information, so you want to continue.
The journey through the educational process is a long journey, and one where the family, in every instance possible, needs to have good rapport with the school district. This is not always possible, but when it is possible, because it's a long relationship over many years, and we would have to be substantially larger organization to be physically present at all the IEP meetings where there's a need. There are luckily some other federally funded organizations that specialize in training for parents. We do also a tremendous amount of training and have training materials on our website because to the greatest extent possible that we can help a family raise their capacity to effectively self-advocate. That's crucial because we just physically can't be there. But the eligibility for them to request our services is absolutely there, and then we'll just kind of take it from there. We do have to prioritize the highest risk situations, mm-hmm. and that's what we do is, try to assess. And there are some situations where it's just desperate and maybe family not in a position to self-advocate due to other barriers that they face. So we work through that and try to help everybody as much as we can. And it is an opportunity for the public to contribute financially to reduce the number of people who we can't fully serve. And you're welcome to visit our website and donate through Network for Good, where we have an account, and we'd be happy to continue to accept your support.
Will you share all the necessary information as far as website and telephone number? And
sure. One more time. The website is www.disabilityrightsflorida.org. The phone number is 1-800-342-0823. We also have a TDD line, which is 1-800-346-4127, and you can contact us through the mail at our main address, 2728
Centerview Drive.
And also at that location, we take walk-in intake. You're welcome to just come to the office.
Okay. As we continue to look at the goals, I know another goal is individual rights. Share with us just what you plan, what your attempt to accomplish through individual rights.
This category includes things like transition and due process. And I think you've heard a theme around disputes that need to be resolved. And so we advocate for the rules to be fair and for them to then be fairly implemented. So that's something we do at the systemic and at the individual level. We advocate for people in facility to have the right to a grievance process. We advocate for parents to have more authority in the IEP process. Okay. And there are some wonderful champions in the legislature that have moved that forward. And taken that initiative, and we provide them with information about what our clients are experiencing and why that will be helpful. It centers around our clients' rights to privacy, our clients' rights to due process, and our clients' rights under the ADA and other laws. Brian, did you want to add something here?
Well, no, I think you've pretty well covered it. Due process is a big term that encompasses a lot of different issues. There are elements of due process that individuals can self-advocate in, and we oftentimes offer technical assistance wherein an attorney or an advocate tries to give an individual the information they need to advocate for themselves. And there's some due process that is really better suited to attorneys, in which case, where we see merit, we can and do provide attorneys to litigate on someone's behalf. I handle a lot of Medicaid due process, as an example. And now a lot of employment due process with the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation.
Okay. Community integration. How do you interface with the community? I know you have community outreach, correct, where you reach out in the rural and underserved groups.
Our outreach staff are everywhere, mm-hmm. and they are amazing. Getting themselves invited to and setting up booths at events, small and large, in counties, remote and urban. And we have the ability to take intake confidentially at the booth. If you visit us at a booth, we have an iPad kiosk that is fully accessible where you can submit your request for assistance right there with a little staff support. We distribute publications, and we distribute, you know, material about how people can access. The issue of community integration within our priorities, you know, has to do with fundamental concepts like segregation,
mm-hmm.
Which influence, what happens for people with disabilities is that, and especially thinking of children, when a child is educated in a segregated environment, it prepares them for life in segregation. When a child is educated with non-disabled peers, as anticipated by federal law, whenever possible, mm-hmm. to the maximum extent possible, it prepares them for life in the community. We have to have high expectations that people with the accommodations and supports, which is the part of, that they're entitled to, whether that be interpretation, technology, behavioral services supports, treatment of medical or other type, a variety of things that they're entitled to, so that they can be successful in the community. And it has to start early. When we talk with families about transition planning, one of the central messages is it's never too early to start. And if you want your son or daughter to be in employment or in post-secondary, you have to advocate for them to be included early, because if they are segregated early, they are being prepared for a life where their skills are more suited to an institutional or segregated environment. People, you may know this from your experience, Dr. Hollifield, people don't readily transition from deep-end segregation to the community. They're actually made more disabled because of their lack of opportunity mm-hmm. to practice independent living skills, whether those skills are choice making or physical management of an environment or just all the skills of life. So that's what community integration means.
Okay.
And that's what the community and the movement's been fighting for some decades now.
Now, you have offices throughout the state. Do they function independently?
I would say no. We are one big team of roughly 59 or 60 people.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, if you contact us, our phone system is integrated. Everything is integrated. We do have some satellite locations that are additional to the Tampa, Hollywood, and Tallahassee. And the cross-training is substantial and the knowledge is widely shared. So we function as one team, and the intake staff sort of figure out – the intake staff and the management staff sort of figure out who the best staff is to handle specific
problems. From my perspective, I just actually moved from Tallahassee down to Tampa, so I changed offices. And it's remarkable how little my workflow and my day-to-day effort has changed. I see new faces every morning, but I work with the same people. I work on the same cases. It is really a very unified environment.
Okay. So
I agree with that as well, because I, as well as Brian, just recently moved from the Tallahassee office to the Hollywood office. And just like he said, the transition is smooth, and I'm working the cases that I would work from the Tallahassee office. And like he said, just seeing different people but doing the same work.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because I asked that because I was thinking of the individual who may not have access to the Tallahassee office, or maybe, you know, in some more remote location. Do they get the same type of service? Do they get the same thing, even if they aren't here? And so that's why I asked you all that question.
Sure. And you know, oftentimes, if it seems important, we will go to our clients.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great.
Yeah. I've often driven out to clients, you know, hours away to visit them and help them with their issues.
Okay. As we look at you know, education and individual rights, what type of accommodations have you all made in the classroom? I think particularly I'm thinking of testing. You know, testing is a real stressful issue for parents and for students. I'm always amazed when I hear that. This is a little sidebar, but I have some students coming in from Gadsden in a couple of weeks, and I asked them, you know, what do you want to talk about? You know what they want to talk about? Pressure for doing well on test. Pressure to make sure, and these are middle school students. So I turn that question over to you, all of you, as far as what are the accommodations that are for those who aren't transitioning out, those who may be in middle school, that are going through test anxiety and parents, and, you know, sometimes we have to make special accommodations for the testing. And I think that's been an area where we've seen a lot of egregious type of behavior.
Melissa, do you want to start with that one?
Sure. Just like you said, Dr. Hollyfield, not, you know, testing can cause anxiety. Not everybody does well on tests.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to, you know, educate the school on that it's not always the test that will determine the abilities of a student. There are other ways to test and measure what they have learned. But we also can request that certain accommodations be applied to that student in a testing setting, such as extended time on the test, maybe directions being read back to the student, a different sort of format for the testing that would not modify what the test is asking, but perhaps ask it in a different way.
Okay.
Such as maybe fill in the blank as opposed to multiple choice, different things like that.
Do you find that the school districts are receptive? Because some of the things that you're asking for require some more money. They require some additional staff to perform these accommodations.
Unfortunately, what we find is that accommodations that have been designed and agreed to by the IEP
mm-hmm.
team
mm-hmm.
and which may be, not always, but may be successfully being implemented in the classroom don't get implemented on the most high-stakes day that the child mm-hmm. is confronted. The rush to administer the knowledge transition between, you know, different personnel. So we really have to troubleshoot for that. And one of the things we advise families to be aware of is that they, you know, they really have to ask and double-check that the classroom accommodations that have been approved for the testing situation do, in fact, occur.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's no good to design them and agree to them if they don't actually get implemented. And we work with families a lot around asking for the evaluations that are needed to help the team of educators and the parents understand the nature of the child's disability at a more deep level. Sometimes the design is not effective of what the accommodations are because there's an untapped bit of knowledge. I'll give you an example that was actually an abuse situation where a child was repeatedly secluded, and it was for punishment was completely inappropriate. Seclusion should only be in a physical management emergency where there's an imminent risk of very significant danger to the adult or the child. But in this case, it was being used for noncompliance.
Mm-hmm.
And this was in a special ed school. But what ended up being discovered is that the child had an undetected hearing loss.
Mm.
So getting the full picture
mm-hmm.
is crucial. And mm-hmm. That's a dollar issue as well. And mm-hmm. getting those evaluations timely, comprehensively is crucial to design around the child's needs. If we overlook a crucial need around an aspect of the disability, we're really doing a disservice to the
mm-hmm.
child.
Yeah. Wow. Well,
and also it's important to remember that when you're doing the IEP, that you want to make sure that testing accommodations, such as in-class testing, not just high-stakes testing, but in-class testing, that the accommodations are listed in the IEP as well, and not just verbally stated or verbally agreed to, but actually written into the IEP for regular classroom testing, and that they're being requested for high-stakes testing, such as SCAT testing as well.
Where does the time go? They just told me I have 2 minutes, and I have about 20 more questions to ask you. Let me see. Do you educate clients in regards to consumer choice? Is that something that you do when I say consumer choice?
This is a fantastic question, Dr. Hollifield. And I just want to – we are dedicated to not only defending the choice rights of individuals with disabilities, but making that meaningful. And one of the tenets of our movement is that it is not a meaningful choice if the full continuum of options is not funded and available, and if the individual has not had the opportunity to see it and try it. So we often encounter situations where, you know, we will be told the parent, the community has chosen segregation. Mm-hmm. And the reality is they've never had the opportunity to visit independent living. They don't have equal readily available funded sources of independent living. This is a very significant issue in the adult mental health community, but it's significant across really all disabilities. The opportunity to be discharged from a facility is only realistic if the community services are funded, if they are the individual has access to choose them, and that the staff can support and facilitate their transition.
Well, we are out of time, but I just would like to say thanks so much. Your information is always invaluable, and we appreciate you taking the time to come and share it with me and the listening audience. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. This edition of 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Hollifield. Technical engineer, Evan Rossi. Audio copies are available, and if you would like to participate in 411 Team or have topic suggestions, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. That's 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Team podcast, log in wfsu.org.